All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? I am Mark Maron. This is my podcast. How's it going? Today on the show, look at me setting up the show properly. Today on the show, Lee Daniels, the director, producer, writer of Empire, The Butler, Monsters Ball. He's going to be here. We talked for about an hour. I had a tight window, but it was good. I think we locked in and we got some stuff done. We emotionally bonded and challenged each other a little bit, and it was exciting. It was moving. I needed one of those. I needed one of those where I'm like, this kind of, I don't know, making me have feels. Is that how the kids say it? Feels? Is that where we're at? So, what's happening? I'm sick. Not only do I have like 4 stitches in my mouth, now I've got a fucking cold. I'm sure you can hear it, but the show must go on, okay? The show must go on. But if you're wondering why I sound weird, that's it. Those two things. Harry Dean Stanton passed away, which is sad. He was very old, but it's sad still. Nonetheless, does not matter. He was one of those guys that you just always thought was going to be there forever on some level. And he is, because he's done so many movies. But we did repost the original interview I did with him, which if any of you have been with me for a long time, I was very insecure about. And a lot of people got mad at me because they said it was fine. He was old and I was too hard on myself, or what did you expect, you idiot? He's an old man. But I just wanted to say that we did put that interview back up if you wanted to check in with that. I did see that new movie, Lucky, too, that it would have to be his last movie. And I think it was a very personal movie for him, I think. And I'm not being paid to say this, and I don't know where I got the film or who sent it to me. It was directed by John Carroll Lynch, who is also an actor that you might remember played Francis McDormand's husband in Fargo. But the movie stars Harry Dean, and he's this like 90-year-old atheist who has outlived and outsmoked his contemporaries. So it's not him, but it is him in a way, I believe. And it's a pretty great movie. David Lynch is in it, Ron Livingston, Tom Skerritt has a part in it. There's a lot of older cats that you haven't seen in a while, but I recommend it. I don't know where you can find it, but it's a good movie. It's called Lucky. And if you have a Jones to see the last film that Harry Dean Stanton did, I believe, I'm not mistaken, you should watch that, because it's a poetic little movie. It's a little stylized, but it's great if you love Harry Dean. Okay, I just wanted to put that out there. I'm a little raw. I'm fucking sick. So here's what's going on. Let's read a couple emails. I want to talk about Eric Clapton for a minute. I talked about the teabag situation. That sounds dirty, but it's not. First, the emails. Here we go. It says, dude, subject line, dude, is that really your butt in glow? Please say yes. That's from Ross. So I wrote back, of course. And he wrote back, nice. I thought it was a nice exchange. I wanted to share it with you. Here's another one. Subject line, too good. My girlfriend farted in front of me for the first time while laughing, watching Too Real. So thanks for that intimate moment and progression in our relationship. Your best work yet. Glad to help out, man. That was from Marcus. That's a big moment for a couple, and I'm proud. I'm proud of the special, but at this moment, I'm more proud that I facilitated that wonderful moment between you two. And you're welcome. And thank you for watching Too Real on Netflix. I appreciate that. Now, the tea issue. Let's get to the tea issue. As you know, I spoke about buying a bag of PG Tips that had 1,150 tea bags in it, which was too much. It's a lot of pressure. Don't think I'm going to make it. It's very intimidating. It's a harbinger of my mortality. There's a lot of problems with it. And I've stuffed that big bag into a cabinet, and I have a little tin for PG Tips, so I'm just filling the tin. But I got an email after actually talking about unloading the PG Tips. PG Tips wanted Eagle Rock, which is close to me. My name is Will, and my wife and I recently moved to Eagle Rock from London. I was listening to your Lord WTF episode and heard you've overordered PG Tips tea bags. Like true English, we both drink quite a lot of PG Tips. Congrats, as it's the only tee, and are down to our last small box. So I'd be up for buying some off you if you wanted. No joke. Love the podcast, by the way. Cheers, Will. And I don't know what's going on with me, but I'm doing some fan outreach. And I wrote back, sure, I can meet you later today. I'll bring some. When is good? Marin. Will. Amazing. Afraid I'm at work the weekdays in Wilshire, but can either come meet you on the weekend or on my way home one night after work, if that's cool. Just let me know how much money. Thanks so much. And I said, maybe over the weekend. I don't need money. I have a lot of tea. Marin. He said, yeah, weekend is cool. I'm around. Great. Thank you so much. PG Tips is literally the only thing we get homesick for. And then he wrote, hey, Mark, let me know when it's good. Then he started pressuring me a little bit. Let me know when it's good this weekend. I felt a Jones coming. Like, you know, I teased him. I teased him with this big drop of PG Tips, which is a highly addictive substance. So he says, going to be on York Boulevard in about an hour if that works. Also have some vinyl for you to say thanks. Cheers, Will. So now, like, you don't know. You email a mid-level celebrity like myself. You don't know if, like, I'm going to get back to you or what. So now he's sweetening the deal with vinyl. Like, he's like, he needs his stuff. But he's like, I don't know if Marin's really on the level with this shit. It's audacious that I would expect this to happen with a mid-level celebrity such as Marc Maron. That's what I'm projecting onto him. And then I said, I have to go by Rock Dog and Cat on Colorado next to the Poke place in the strip mall. Can you be there at 4:30? I'll hand off the goods. And Will said, cool. See you then. No cops. So I did a T-drop in the parking lot of a strip mall. Did a PG Tip T-drop for my English pal, and got a couple records. I don't go crazy. I'm not going to be doing that every week. It's just I'm fragile. I'm vulnerable. I'm a little ill. I'll explain it later. Oh man. So I went and saw Clapton, and as some of you know, I don't. Well, here's the thing, and I guess I can tell you. I'm a tremendously big fan of Jimmy Vaughn. Now, I don't know if you know who Jimmy Vaughn is. Jimmy Vaughn is a guitar player. He's Stevie Ray Vaughn's older brother. And he had a band called the Fabulous Thunderbirds. And the first two Fabulous Thunderbirds records are, for my money, or from where I'm sitting, two of the greatest sort of Texas blues records that you can own. Just beautiful fucking jump blues, guitar point. I mean, he's a classicist of blues guitar playing and great blues music, a lot of it from the Texas guys. I guess what I'm getting at is, yes, I did interview Jimmy Vaughn, but that's not what this is about. Jimmy Vaughn and another cat that he plays guitar with, Billy Pittman, who I also know, they were opening for Clapton at the Forum. And after I talked to Jimmy in here, which you'll hear eventually, he let me play with him too. It was a real fucking honor. You got to check out the first two Fabulous Thunderbirds records. Girls Go Wild, What's the Word? Just get those two. I play guitar with those two records more than almost any other record. Like, even more than Peter Green. Those first two Fabulous Thunderbirds records. So for me, it was a real thrill and honor to hang out with Jimmy Vaughn. So they're opening for Clapton at the Forum. It's Jimmy Vaughn and his band, then Gary Clark, and then Clapton. Now, as some of you know, I respect Clapton, but I've been a little bored by him at times. But I went to see these guys, and I watched Jimmy, and I hung out, and Jimmy showed me some licks, and he gave me some strings. He told me I got to do flat wounds. That's where it's at. This is only important to guitar players. But, like, I watched Clapton, and I think I figured it out. It's not, he's always been pretty laid back, right? It's just as he got older, you know, he doesn't put any effort into, you know, he'll just wear some stonewashed jeans, maybe some cargo pants, Birkenstocks or Docksiders, and just a short sleeve shirt. And I don't know what I'm expecting from a 71-year-old man, but, you know, he's just very grounded and has nothing to fucking prove. And he just sat there. He did like three fucking rockers, and he sat down with an acoustic and did a bunch of his hits on acoustic. And then he picked up the electric again, did White Room and some other shit. And, you know, I'm not saying it was riveting, but it was pleasant. And the one thing that I felt was that when he did lay out a lead, and he's really done his homework on the acoustic blues playing over the years, man, he really fucking knocks that shit out. That was really some of the best. the acoustic blues. And that's probably where he's at. He's a real blues guy. He just, you know, he's not going to, you know, run around like Mick Jagger. He's just going to be up there, be slow hand, lay back, take it easy, not talk to the audience, do his fucking job. He seems like a very grounded, sober, spiritual dude, you know, in a way that's almost shy. But I'll tell you the one thing, like one thing I'd love to see, like, you know, when they do hit that lead, like during White Room or whatever, during one of the classic old ones, what do you do? A Key to the Highway, you know, it's like, can't we just lay out a 20-minute jam? You know, can't we just do that? Because when he'd get on those runs, I'm like, that's why he's fucking great. Those runs are outstanding. These blues runs. And I'm like, yeah, I'm just watching his fingers on the big screen. Anyway, I'm sorry that I dismissed Eric Clapton for being boring. He's a wizard, and he is like, it's a lot of responsibility to to be a guitar hero and to hold that mantle, and he fucking did. And I'm sorry, Eric. All right, not that you listen, not that I talked to you, not that I even met you, but there you have it. Okay, if it's great job. I just wish maybe a 12-minute lead. 12-minute, like, jam. Just fucking lay it out cream style, right? Why not? Maybe I left too soon. Did you do that? Are you still playing now? I don't know. Maybe the show is continuing. Okay, Lee Daniels was in and out here. He was doing a junket, doing other interviews. You know, he's got his show Empire and Star premieres the new season on September 27th. My birthday. And I was happy to talk to him. It was kind of intense. This is me and Lee Daniels. So you had a production call right there. Right, just walking in. Yeah, you're dealing with some...
Dude.
What?
It's hard.
Is it?
Is, yeah.
For which show?
Star.
Uh-huh.
And it was about music. And
yeah.
It's just so hard. It's so hard.
But you deal with that every day. Like, right?
I know, but I was literally, we're trying to find a song about,
yeah,
in one of the episodes where, as a finale number.
Yeah.
That's sort of like about where we are right now as a country.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted it to be my interpretation of We Are the World,
right.
A hipper sort of... But I remember when We Are the World was done, I felt that even though they had all those stars there, it felt a little like cutie.
Sure,
like, almost like Disneyland-y.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
But it was what it was. And so I'm trying to find a rougher, grittier version of that song.
That song,
not
exactly.
Not that song exactly,
right.
But sort of like an inspiration. Something. That, you know, because we're in a fucked up place right now.
Bad.
So I'm just trying to find a song that is that.
Why don't you hire a bunch of cats to cover that thing?
We do.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
That was the call that I was making as I was walking into the door. Are we recording?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah. And then you're shifting gears, and I'm thinking as I'm driving up, okay, where am I going? What am I doing?
Right now. Tonight, mm-hmm.
As
or today.
I walk into here right now to this great space that is filled with such.
You got to ground yourself.
Yeah, I'm adjusting to it because it's a pretty Afro pick and everything. It's pretty. it's my kind of style. It really is my kind of style.
You like clutter?
Mm-hmm.
Historical clutter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is that what your house looks like?
Mm-hmm.
You're right. Well, that's good. I appreciate it, guy. A collector.
Yeah.
You're a collector.
My mother calls it junk.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know why. I don't. It's comforting to me.
It's very soothing. I feel right at home trying to figure out. Already, I want to like attack the books. And I'm loving that thing right there that I grew up with.
The troll doll?
Yeah, man.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot like of home. Stuff.
Well, then you got the Bible. It's like, it's
a
little
a few
bit of
Bibles. Hodge,
but you go from the Bible to homeboy over there.
Yeah. To which one? Oh, to Tyson?
Tyson, yeah.
Well, that's just a weird picture that somebody put. that somebody put the tattoo that I used for my logo on a bunch of different people.
Yeah.
And that was what that was. So you don't live here?
I do.
You do?
Here. I did, man. I'm homeless right now. I live in New York.
You're breaking my heart.
I'm not homeless. No, I ain't that kind of homeless. I've been that homeless.
Yeah.
But I'm not that kind of homeless. But I prefer that kind of homeless, actually.
Really?
Yeah, because if, you know, I know what time it is. You know
sure.
what I mean? But
yeah,
this is a
level playing field. Yeah. when you got nothing, you got nothing left
exactly.
to lose.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But this is a different type of a homeless in that my home is yeah. New York, you know?
Right.
And I've shows in Atlanta and in New York and in Chicago. So I go back and forth between both cities.
Empire's in Chicago?
Mm-hmm.
No kidding.
Yeah, shooting in Chicago.
You shoot all there.
Mm-hmm. So I stay at a hotel there, and then I stay at a hotel in Chicago. And then I...
Nice hotel. I like Chicago.
I do too.
I like, in
the summertime or in the autumn. No, yeah. I can't mess with that.
I didn't know about Chicago for years, and I started playing there and working there, and I was like, this is a real city with its own thing. Mm. You know, it's really grounded. It's a good place.
Mm.
I mean, I know it's got its problems, but I mean, it's a nice city.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
Atlanta, I never really got a handle on Atlanta, but
it's not bad.
Yeah.
It's not bad. It's actually
there's some good groovy
folks. It's as nice as Chicago.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And now it's like a big, it's like the hub of show business.
I'm told.
Yeah, what are you shooting there? You know, right? They're shooting all kinds of shit there.
I'm not, you know, you get into your bubble of
right.
what it is, so you really don't know about other people's
sure.
worlds.
Yeah, but where'd you grow up?
Philadelphia.
When it was tough.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The move experience, Rizzo
yeah.
as mayor experience. Yeah.
And it was, I like Philly now.
It's beautiful.
Right?
It's really well,
what?
You go downtown, it's
yeah,
beautiful.
Yeah.
And then you step into North Philadelphia and you step into the depths of West Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And you see the countless rows of homes that are abandoned. And then you see one little home, like row homes, and you see
yeah.
one like all these abandoned homes,
yeah.
boarded up even,
yeah.
and then you'll see a person living on that street.
Yeah.
Literally one family out of a 13 row home.
Yeah.
Family. It's pretty intense.
Why is that? What happened?
I don't know.
You don't know?
It's really deep. It's
yeah.
really, yeah.
It's but just, it's not like...
I drove, my brother had a family
yeah.
that lived in Philadelphia, and I drove down the street, and it was like all these abandoned homes, and
yeah.
then there was this house.
And it's just the way it is, because it's not like Detroit. It didn't
yeah, it
die.
Is. I'm sorry, but certain parts of Philadelphia, it's bad.
It just died.
It's just died.
It's gone.
Yeah. And the houses are just there.
What about where you grew up? Is it still alive?
Yeah. It's
yeah?
so funny, you know. It's secular. When we moved in, we were the first black family that lived on our street
yeah.
in West Winfield.
Yeah.
And it was a bunch of white people lived in. And then they sort of skirted off to the suburbs.
Right after you moved there?
Yeah. And then it became all black. And
yeah.
now it's, and now because there's a college there, St. Joe's, it's now white again with sprinkles of
yeah.
African-American families.
So it all comes back around.
Mm-hmm.
But when you grew up there, it was just a working class neighborhood?
Yeah. Lower middle class.
Yeah.
It was a middle class neighborhood that became lower middle class.
Uh-huh. And what was your family's, what did your old man do?
He was a cop.
Really?
Mm-hmm. He was a cop that worked for Rizzo, Frank
oh, wow.
Rizzo. And,
yeah.
You know, when you think of some of my earliest memories were a group of white men crying over my father's body and in oh. blue. And
how
and
old were they?
15.
Uh-huh. That's when they start? Those are some of your earliest memories?
I mean, you know.
Yeah.
No, I know. My earliest memory was pooping
yeah.
in my grandfather's shoe.
You did that?
Mm-hmm.
On purpose, I would imagine.
I don't know. I don't remember. I just remember pooping in my grandfather's shoe.
That's a very it's a tough coincidence to accept. Like, you know, it doesn't sound like it just happened.
Oh, yeah.
But your father was killed in duty,
mm-hmm.
on duty,
mm-hmm.
gunned down?
Mm-hmm. He lived... the way he died.
Yeah.
Which was a violent death.
He was a violent man?
Mm-hmm.
How many siblings you got?
Four.
Yeah. And it was a violent family?
Not all the time.
Yeah. Just a lot of stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
Explosive.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry you went through that.
I thought it was normal.
It's hard to process. Have you processed it? I mean, have you worked through it?
I'm working through it.
Yeah?
Yeah, I work through it through my work.
Yeah?
Yeah, and then I learned that wasn't enough. So now, you know, I do therapy and...
Yeah?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you work through it in your work, or were you avoiding it through your work? Do you know what I mean? Like, I know you work, people, artists, you know, create stuff that resonates with them and moves them through stuff, but a lot of times you seem like a very busy guy. So I imagine that sometimes, you know, just working gets you away from, you know, whatever emotions that you...
Wow, that's a very powerful statement, and I think it's accurate. It's very accurate, because you don't... And then you come back and, whoa, you still got the same problems.
Right.
But I do everything that I do. It comes from a place of experience.
Sure. Right.
And so it is really therapeutic. Then I come back to still what you just said.
Yeah, who you are.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm 57, and so I'm, you know, for the first time ever, I've been in therapy.
Yeah.
And it seems to be working.
You look good.
I feel good, man. I feel good.
I'm glad it's working. So, because, like, you know,
I'm not drinking. I'm going through this sober thing.
Oh yeah, I've been sober a long time.
Me too. I'm in AA.
Yeah, me too.
I don't know whether I should.
You're not supposed to, but that's all
I'm
right.
I'm not supposed to say.
I talk about it all the time.
I'm not supposed to.
No, you can.
Why?
According to the program.
Uh-huh.
You want to know originally why?
Yeah.
They didn't want people who were famous people talking about it because they didn't want those people to they don't want to have public representatives of the program. Because let's say that, like, somebody gets sober because of you. You said AA, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden maybe you don't stay sober. Then whoever, then they're like, well, that's the reason I got sober. Right, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, like, so
can we delete this part?
No,
then?
No. I talk about it all the time. I'm just mm-hmm. telling you what the tradition means. How long have you been sober?
6 months.
Oh, so you're in it. So you're doing it.
I mean, no.
Yeah.
I got sober.
Yeah.
And then I got sober. I mean,
no, I get it.
I was on drugs.
Yeah.
You know, some 15 years ago.
Right.
And then I got, and so I, and I drank.
Yeah.
And then I recently just said,
Right.
I don't know why.
Mm? Well, good. So this is an exciting time. You're going to find out a lot about yourself.
Well, I'm knowing that I'm having difficulty now having sober sex.
Yeah.
That's right. Something that's
yeah, not as loose as you used to
no.
be.
Maybe that's something to do with me being 57 too.
Sure.
Not that, really, like, you know, yeah. Something, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a little more, you know, you can't hide from yourself as much.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard, man. It's hard.
I think, now I've been really honest with who I am
uh-huh.
and what I've been through,
uh-huh.
and a lot of people are receptive, and a lot of people are not, and I've never cared.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah.
As long as I'm staying and living in my truth, even when I was high.
Yeah,
saying I'm high.
Yeah, but I'm living in my truth. I'm truly high.
And I'm high.
Yeah,
and people would look at me like, he's high for saying that he's high.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting thing.
Like, oh my God, where's this interview going?
Well, how far along are you in the Richard Pryor movie?
I'm not. I was. I related to it so much because I did what he did. I was on cocaine.
Yeah.
And we were going to do it.
Yeah.
And then I just sort of, I don't know. I got caught up in TV land, and it really sucks you in.
It's very demanding.
In. Yeah.
It's not like I'm going away for 6 months to make a movie.
I didn't know that though. Oh. When I signed up for it.
Oh.
I didn't even know that the show was going to be it. I didn't even know the show was going to get picked up.
Empire.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's the first. And so I didn't know that we were going to get picked up. So I did it as a, you know what? Whitney Cummings came in. Do you know who she is?
Sure.
She came over and said, why are you poor? I'm going, she says, you get these Oscars for people.
Yeah.
But you're like, why are you?
When did she say this to you? Well, you say she just came over? How did you know?
Because she's friends, you know?
Yeah,
she
sure.
came over and she was
to
like.
To your house.
Mm, New York. And she says, Lee, I get a lot of money.
Yeah,
I mean, a lot of money. And if you do a TV show, you can get a lot of money. And I go, really? What kind of money? And then she told me what kind of money. And I said, are you? And she said, yeah. And that's just like, I said, okay. So when my partner, who wrote The Butler, came to me and said, okay, let's just do another movie about, we had in common, we loved on King Lear.
Yeah.
And we wanted to do a family about a black sort of hip hop
thing.
Yeah. Yeah, we were going to do it as a film.
Yeah.
And I said, no, let's do it as a TV show.
Right.
Because I think I'm told by my friend Whitney that we can make money. So
television.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we didn't think that the pilot was going to get picked up because no one was buying African-American anything.
Mm-hmm.
So we literally went off to do, I was going to do Richard Pryor afterwards. And then it got picked up, which meant, oh my God, okay, that's great.
Got to make more.
You got to do 13 more. And I said, well, what does that mean? So now we had to sit and think about what that meant as a season.
Yeah.
And that's time consuming.
And oh, yeah. So, and you got a writing room? You got a crew? Oh, dude,
it was so deep. And then I am making money.
Yeah.
And then they say, hey, Lee, you want a deal?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah, we like you over here. Yeah, you're making money. We had no idea.
I said, what kind of money? Because I really have never been motivated by money.
Yeah, right.
Maybe I have been motivated by money, but
gotta be a little bit.
I always wanted to do it to make sure it's important.
Yeah.
Or that I could make my kids proud.
Right.
At the end of what's important.
Right.
For me.
Yeah.
And but the kids were going to college, and so I said, I ain't got the money. That is the most phallic. This is crazy, this room. I love this room. Mushroom, but
is it really a
penis head? What is it exactly?
It's a mushroom, but I mean, it could be a colorful penis head. A mosaic giant penis head. So you're saying kids are in college.
I had to put the kids through college.
How many kids you got?
Two.
Yeah.
Twins.
Yeah.
And 21 now.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, wanted to go to expensive school. So I was sort of forced into the TV world, but then it became a job. Work.
Sure. Yeah, cool.
You know, and it was like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah. There's no end. There's
no, there. Oh yes, there is.
Yeah, there is. Mm-hmm. Okay. But not in the foreseeable future, really. Right.
No, cause they just keep spitting them out.
What do you mean they're not?
But I'm forcing myself to do a film. So, but going back to the Richard Pryor of it all, I'm no longer at this point going to direct it. I'm going to produce it.
Oh, okay, okay. Mm-hmm. So Epps is still moving forward.
Oh, for sure.
And there's a script being written.
The script has been written
by you.
No, well, I did a pass on the script. Bill Condon.
Oh yeah,
he's an incredible writer. It's very Bob Fosse. It's very
good. Well, that's good.
All that jazz, except.
And he's going to direct it too.
But no, Bill's not. He was going to direct it.
Yeah,
but he's not. So we're looking for a director right now.
Oh well, so what they based what book they based it on, or where
they didn't base it off anything.
They just put it together.
They put it together, you know, from
his life.
A couple of documentaries.
That's exciting.
Some of the kids, the wife.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. The wife, some of the kids, not all the kids, but a couple of them. But I'm sort of fascinated with like the sort of nuts and bolts of how you got to where you are from like, was show business the thing in the beginning when you were a kid? Was that what you saw yourself doing? Because you're like a mogul. You're like, and you've done a lot of different elements of show business. Mm. You've been a manager, a producer, a writer, an actor a bit, a director.
Well, I'm not really an actor. I only acted because there's nobody else to stand in and say the lines that was good. So I had to come in and say, you know what I mean?
Right, right. But all that other stuff, you know, and you came up.
I'm not an actor.
Okay.
I tried. I'm in the first episode of my new season because, again, you know.
I'd
say one word.
That's nice to have you. It's like it's like signing a thing.
Mm.
You know what I mean? There's a guy. Mm-hmm. It's like Hitchcock in his movie.
Yeah, a little bit.
So, but how do you get from Philly to here? I mean, I know it's a long story.
The first book I read was literally, I went to the this is exactly how it happened.
Yeah.
I went to the public library. I went into the theater section.
Yeah.
I saw a book that was titled Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf by Edward Albee.
Mm.
I read the book in the library. I got a library card. I came home. I had all my friends on the stoop and my sisters and my brother act out all the parts. Martha and George.
Really?
Everybody, yep. And it sort of just took over from that point.
You did a stoop production of...
stoop production.
Yeah, of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Mm-hmm. And then I went to Edward Albee many years later to ask if I could do it black, and he said no.
Did you really?
Mm-hmm.
That must have hurt a little.
A little.
Did he give you any reason, or that was the end?
Nope.
What a bastard.
I don't know. I guess he sees it a certain way, and I understand that.
Yeah, but it's a play. You release it out into the world. I'm not going to argue with you or Edward Albee, but
I'd love to do it as a play. I'd love it. I think it's a great play. It, you know,
you could probably do. Oh, you wanted to do a movie?
Yeah.
Oh, you could probably do a play.
I don't think he allowed it.
That's a condition. Like, that would be crazy.
I believe.
By the way, this can't be done by black people.
I believe so.
Huh.
Don't quote me.
I won't. So you go from there to, like, how old are you when that happens?
8 or 9.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
So you wanted to be in show business from that point?
I didn't
point
know
on.
That it was show business. I didn't.
But
really
you liked
know.
It.
I didn't know what it was.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because it wasn't any really, there weren't, you know, my grandfather owned he was the manager of a theater. So I saw a lot of black exploitation films as a kid. Shaft and Superfly and Claudine and The Lady Sings the Blues. And a whole, there was a period of wonderful cinema.
Yeah.
Where people, and then there was some great television at the time, Norman Lear television.
Yeah.
Was inspirational, but I didn't really know that was what, I didn't know that was called a director or a writer or a creator.
Yeah.
I just knew that I wanted to be a part of something that I didn't know what it was. So I went to school.
Where at?
I went to Lindenwood Colleges in St. Louis, in St. Charles, Missouri.
Uh-huh.
I don't know why.
You don't know why.
That was the only place that probably would accept me.
You graduated high school and you end up in Missouri.
Went to an all-white high school. All white high school, which is really interesting. Back in the '70s,
how was that for you?
Fantastic.
Yeah,
my neighbor was a butler.
Yeah,
I ended up doing a movie because of him,
mm-hmm.
called The Butler. And he, my mom knew that early on that I would get in trouble. The vice principal of my junior high school said that I would amount to nothing, that I was going to end up dead. And my mother said, "No, he won't." And Mr. Brodsky's his name.
Yeah,
and so. So my neighbor worked for a chauffeur that owned the Philadelphia Eagles, and he lived in Villanova.
Yeah,
and so he said, "Well, why don't we use his address?" Ed Snyder was his name, and we used his address, and he was kind enough to let me. And I went to I literally was transported from an all African American world to a completely where I was the only spot in the spot. Okay, so it was just. Me and maybe a couple others, and it was great.
So that
I didn't experience racism at all, which is I don't know how that is, but I didn't, or I was too naive to see it.
Yeah, and this is high school.
Mm-hmm.
You would have known.
Yeah, I would have known.
Sure.
Yeah, I would have. I didn't. I auditioned for a play called The Sound of Music, and I couldn't understand why it was that they wouldn't give me the role of something Von Trapp.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, why? I did a better audition than this knucklehead.
Yeah.
And they gave me Max instead. I played the Nazi, I think. Nazi sympathizer.
I think that's all right. That's pretty good casting.
So that was
there's some power in that.
That was my first.
The irony.
It was the first job ever. And the bug was there. Again, I didn't know what it was. And so I went to college to study political science because I wanted to make my dead father happy.
Yeah.
Because he wanted me to be a lawyer.
Uh-huh.
And
isn't that weird how you still honor him? Even if your feelings are mixed about them,
mm-hmm.
that you still honor them even when you may not want to.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that during that? Like, you know, like why am I doing that?
Yes. Do you?
Well, I do. Like, you know, I what I find is that, you know, my father's still alive and, you know, he has sort of receded a bit in my psyche and in my heart. But you know, I do things like him. And I, you know, when I talk to him, I have to make sure that I have some very serious boundaries around who I am and who he is. And sometimes it's emotional.
Mm-hmm.
But I try not to show that because
mm-hmm.
I can't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm 53.
You know, and I'm going to be stealing what you just did. Would you just share with me?
Yeah.
I'm stealing that for a scene or two.
Okay.
That I'm serious because it was so visceral.
Okay. You can.
Sometimes you get out of ideas.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you stay with you.
Yeah.
And I steal that moment, that what you just said.
Good.
And you'll go, wait a minute.
That's it.
I, if you're looking maybe episode 12 in of Empire or one of these shows.
Or Star. That would be me talking to somebody. Mm-hmm. Well, good. So, all right. So you don't do the law thing.
I don't do the law thing. I go to, and the political science thing. And second year into school.
Yeah.
I just decided that it was a wrap. I was going with this girl from Hawaii.
Yeah.
And just sort of, I was finding out who I was sexually.
Yeah.
You know? And then another
trial and error.
Yeah, another girl I dated just said, you know, you're gay, don't you? And I go, no. And she says, yeah, you are. So I said, I want to go to Hollywood.
Yeah.
And she said, okay, here's $70. So I think it's either, she gave me $70, I took a bus, and I landed in Hollywood.
And that was that?
Yes.
No plan?
No.
I'm here.
I swear.
Newly gay.
Uh-huh. Is that crazy?
No.
That's crazy. And I was homeless for a little bit. Then I had a nursing agency. I went to work at a nursing agency. At those times, I don't know where they still have them, but the classified ads in the LA Times. And I went and I saw a receptionist, and I became a receptionist at a nursing agency. And it was like,
just because it was a job. Yeah, no,
it was a job.
Oh, no.
I knew I had a good voice. And it was a sales job. And so I was selling nurses, and I knew nothing of nursing. And I could, if your mom got sick or if your dad got sick and they wanted in-home care.
Oh, yeah.
Or if your wife was having a baby and they needed a nanny or whatever.
Oh, that kind of stuff. So it was literally like a booking agency for nurses.
For nurses.
Uh-huh.
And then a year in, they made me the manager because I was a good sales rep. And then after that, I was like, why am I doing this? Oh, and I was living out of a church. You know, I was homeless, and then I moved into a church, and then I was directing theater. That's how it started. I directed theater in the church because they had a theater in the back of the church. And so I was directing in Baldwin Hills. So I was directing theater in the back of a church. And
they just let you live there?
Well, he found out. Yeah, they found out. They found out. But then I moved. I mean, it wasn't long. It was like 3 weeks or 2 weeks or something.
Oh, okay.
You know, it was a short-lived. I mean, when you're homeless, you go from place to place. You know what I mean? So that was a place. But I remained at that church. And they had a theater, and I was directing one acts.
Yeah.
Still unaware of what it was that I wanted to do.
Right.
You know, I went back from acting to directing to really, and then I got a job. I got my first apartment in Hollywood.
Where was the job? You mean that,
the nursing agency?
Yeah, yeah.
And then a year into the nursing agency, after they made me manager, I was like, wait a minute, hold on, something's wrong with this picture. I can do this myself. And so I ended up taking five of their nurses, and I had become friends with all of the, how you get their work there is you become intimate friends with discharge planners at different hospitals and or social workers at different hospitals that call in for help.
Right.
And most of them were African-American women.
Yeah.
And so they would give me work. And before I knew it, I had my own nursing agency, and I had like several hundred nurses that were working for me. I worked out of my apartment. I ended up moving on Welster and La Brea, my offices.
So you're a nurse agent.
Mm-hmm. Still directing theater. And
one acts in Baldwin Hill at the church.
No, I was at that point on Melrose sometimes. We were at the Zephyr.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. And I'd grown a little bit. Yeah.
So you were casting and you were directing?
No, I wasn't casting yet. I was just,
but I mean,
I was still in theater, and then I was at, I still have the nursing agency.
But I mean, how were you putting the plays on? You directing
night.
It, so you cast it, right? So you were putting the whole show together.
Yeah.
So that's how you were starting in show business, and you were booking nurses.
Yes. For the wheelchair.
Got it.
And then the producer of Purple Rain came in.
Yeah.
And asked me if I wanted to, like, he was a client, and he said, what do you want to do?
Oh, at your nursing office. Okay,
he happened to come in because you pay the nurse. I made a lot of money, by the way. That was a lot of money to be made. And by the way, we were the first nursing agency to be under contract with AIDS Project LA.
Oh, wow.
Which is crazy because no one wanted to touch people with AIDS back in those days. And our nurses did. And so we made a lot of money. And then, you know, And that's when the drug use began a lot, because I didn't really, you know, it was,
you had money,
a lot of money,
running a lot of nurses,
and not running a lot of taxes.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you know, and
So let the party begin.
Yes, and sure. So
the guy from Purple Rain
came in, and I ended up doing casting, you know, and then I was casting. I mean, you know, I was.
What do you mean? He said
he said, "What do you want to do?" And yeah. I said, "I want to do. I'm in the entertainment business." He said, "How can you be in the entertainment business and you're taking care of my father?" I said, "Well, I want to be in the entertainment business." He said, "He said, well, this is what you do. You become a PA." I said, "PA, okay." So then,
with a successful business, you're running your own business, and the guy offers, he says, a PA job.
Yeah, I sold a nursing agency
to become a PA.
I sold the nursing agency for a lot of money. And I drove on to the set of Warner Brothers with a Armani suit, a Porsche, and a Newport cigarette.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And ready for my PA job. And that didn't last very long. I went into casting and then became friendly with Prince and, you know.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. So you PA'd on Purple Rain.
Mm-hmm.
And then.
That was casting sort of, but okay. I was fired and. I mean, if you IMDb me, you can't. I'm not even listed as credit. I mean, as I've literally.
But you go as a PA, and they use you for casting. The casting.
Yeah, because he connected. You know, it was all about. It was all about our connection, and it was the suits against, you know,
right.
The black men. Like we knew. I had an eye for talent then.
Yeah,
and so I didn't know that was my God gift then.
Your connection with Prince, you mean? After you met Prince.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we. Yeah. Yeah. The irony is that Clarence Williams III was in that film.
Yeah.
And I cast him in that. And then years later, I get to direct him in The Butler.
Yeah.
That's crazy, crazy. It was like crazy, crazy, crazy.
Yeah.
Luke from Mod Squad.
Yeah, I know. He's good.
He's so good. So good. Anyway, so.
American Gangster. He was a good American Gangster.
Genius.
You're good in your movie? Yeah, yeah, he's great.
But.
So that starts you. Friends with Prince? Did you get
friendly-ish?
Okay. Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
In the beginning, you know, yeah. And then we did Under the Cherry Moon, and then we did a bunch of music videos
with Prince.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And
so that's a good way.
But Warner was really happy with me,
yeah.
And I started working over at Warner Brothers, and I was like head of minority talent.
They called it that?
I don't know what the hell. It was something like that. And I don't know. And it's like, all I know is that, you know,
minority.
I was casting and it was like before, it was pre Spike Lee and post the black exploitation era. So I was sitting there with a pencil and a suit, feeling important like I was a businessman, you know?
On the Warner lot.
Mm.
Minority talent.
I guess something like that.
So you were a casting agent at the studio, basically.
Sort of, yeah. Yes.
Kind of development too, like where you
no development just at all. Casting? And then I just got said, wait a minute, hold on. This is like I wasn't getting fulfilled. So
uh-huh.
Part of the job was watching, going to theater.
Right.
And watching, I'd long given up the desire or didn't even know, like I had no longer done directing theater. And so I was going to see plays, and part of it was seeing all these black plays in New York and L.A. and Chicago. And
what year is this?
This, I don't know.
Yeah.
What's
going on? What were the big plays?
Gossip of Colonus, uh-huh. Morgan Freeman.
Oh, yeah.
I guess it was just post-Dreamgirls, because uh-huh. I was a kid when Dreamgirls was out. So I don't remember the year, but...
But you're scouting.
Mm-hmm. Talent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But for what?
I don't know.
Exactly.
Minority
scouting. So I decided...
Just making a dossier of minority talent.
And so with that... Oh, and I met this wonderful woman who changed my life. Her name was Paula Kelly. And I had seen her in Sweet Charity in the film.
Yeah.
In Sweet Charity with Shirley MacLaine and Cheetah Rivera. And I saw her in Sophisticated Ladies with Gregory Hines on Broadway. And I said, why aren't you working? I need to see you working. I said, light bulb. I'm going to manage you. And so I opened a management company where I was managing actors and you know, I came from a place where as a kid, you know, most of a lot of my family members and neighbors were drug dealers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, or pimps
you knew the hustle? Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah. And so I figured, you know, I would do it with actors.
Yeah.
And so it was really,
You pimp nurses for a while?
Yeah.
Now you're pimp actors.
Yeah, sort of.
And how did you start to build? Like, because you,
I had a
you,
good reputation. I had a really well. I don't know whether it was a good reputation. I had,
but you made.
I made sure that my talent was working. The problem was that they did not have roles that I felt were suitable for the actors that I was working with, and it was embarrassing telling them that they could just play a pimp or a drug dealer or a prostitute at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I learned the game.
Yeah,
I started representing young white kids,
mm-hmm.
and that's when it changed, you know?
Yeah.
And so, and then that took me around the world,
yeah.
you know, and I represented, I don't know, from, and then I ended up representing European, Nastasia Kinski, Aishwarya Rai in India,
who yeah.
was like, you know, the Bollywood princess. And what changed the game for me was when I started representing a kid named Wes Bentley. I found him in a play, and he then starred in American Beauty. And I,
oh, that's that movie, that, the movie, the My Big Break, the documentary.
My Big Break?
About Wes and the people he lived with.
Oh yeah, good yeah. for you. Good for you. I didn't. See, I haven't
that.
Seen. I haven't seen it though.
What do you mean?
No. How should I see it?
Well, I knew you were featured in it somehow.
How?
Well, I mean, Wes is in it.
Yeah, I have to see it.
I'm about halfway doing through it.
Is it going good?
What's weird to watch?
They were all high.
Well, no.
They were all
been.
High. I don't know. We were all high for sure.
But there was two or three of them made it out of that house.
Wes and then Michael Shannon. I found him in Chicago. Was
Michael Shannon? Yeah. You managed him at the beginning?
In the very beginning. I got him his first job. I got him a SAG card in the movie that I produced. It was the second film called The Woodsman.
Yeah. With Kevin Bacon?
Mm-hmm. Kira said, I produced that.
That
was my second. My first movie. So I ended up leaving management because I got tired of... telling African-American actors, you can only play this. Like, right, I got to create right. something. I got to realize I got to take it. I got to up my game.
What was the name of your management agency?
Lee Daniels, a management company.
So you did all right with it. How long were you doing that?
I don't know. Eight right. years?
So that's how, wow, what? That's an amazing story, really.
So then I said, I got tired of that, and I said, I'm going to make my own destiny.
Yeah.
And then I ended up producing my first film, and it was, you know, I don't know how I did it, but we did it, and...
Monsters Ball.
Mm-hmm.
That's a real hammer of a movie.
And that's a way to start a career. I didn't yeah. know that I was doing what I was doing, but I just was doing it.
Yeah.
Doing whatever I could do to make sure that this movie, this vision was executed.
How did that come to you?
The writers
yeah.
came to me because they, at the time, there were many incarnations. I believe Sean Penn, Robert De Niro
yeah.
and Marlon Brando were attached at one time.
Oh, wow.
And
that's big.
Yeah. And they just couldn't get the movie made. And
yeah.
so the writers came to me and I said, I'll do it. Let's figure it out. And Wes Bentley was going to star. He didn't. And so I got Heath to star instead because he was a friend of Wes's.
Uh-huh.
And that really began my career as, you know, and I
as
learned,
a producer.
I, well, you know, Puffy, you know, I don't know what, I guess as a producer, you could say that.
Why wouldn't you say that? What's it, what would you
well,
say?
Well, because I did more than that. Just, I mean, I was very much involved with the,
right.
you know, the acting.
Sure. You knew what you wanted. You
mm-hmm.
knew, yeah, you saw it. So you sort of were a secret co-director.
I don't know whether I don't think that that's the right word to say, because as a director now, I would take deep offense to it.
Okay, so
I think Mark Forrester is a genius, and I think, but I knew that I knew I wanted performances from,
yeah.
and I learned from Mark
yeah.
how to hold a camera,
uh-huh.
and I learned really.
On set.
Literally.
Yeah.
I learned the makings of what, how to direct, you know, in that medium.
Uh-huh.
And also from the medium from when I was on set with other actors,
yeah.
you know, so, that was that, and then I did.
So this is how you went to school,
on set. I yeah. learned how to direct from other directors that I respect. I put my actors with directors that I respected.
And now we're at the point where you're going to direct a movie.
Yeah, and it was the first movie I directed. Well, I was getting cocky, you know.
Yeah,
I was getting cocky, and I was still, you know.
Sure.
Yeah, and I believed the press.
On you.
Believed.
After Monsters Ball.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You believe it.
Yeah. And you're doing coke.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a bad combination.
And
oh, you're yeah, basing too?
Whatever. I got whatever.
You yeah, sure.
It. I've never done heroin. Oh, that's a lie. I did it once. I threw up. I couldn't take it anymore.
I had the exact same experience with heroin. Ever.
Did
the
you?
Exact same
I'll
experience.
I'll never do it again.
Snorted it.
Me too.
Got itchy.
Oh my God.
Threw up.
Me too. Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't need this.
Never. Did you even get high?
No, not then.
I don't remember.
No, I tried it one other time where I smoked it, and I definitely felt the high, but still not for me. I go up. I don't like to go down.
Yeah, me too. I'm with, oh, dude.
Yeah.
We would have been trouble if we knew each other. But anyway, so well, why not? I mean, like, it was a critic's darling. And the same thing with Woodsman. You know, we won Cannes.
It was heavy, man. Kevin playing a child molester. Wasn't and that
I,
it?
Well, yeah. But the thing was, I wanted to not. I remember after Monsters Ball. Like, okay, he's new on the scene.
Yeah.
What are they going to... And so I got offered all these black films.
Right.
Just were in everything that I didn't want my clients as a manager to do.
Right. You know? They're like, he's the minority guy again.
Leprechauns from the Hood, Part 7.
Oh,
I was like, what's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6?
Yeah.
You know, what is that? I never even heard of it. And then, and stuff. So I wanted to do something different. And I had gotten my kids, you know, I raised my brother's kids. I got my...
What happened to your brother?
He was going to jail.
Oh.
And he called me up and he said, can you come? My wife is going to have some kids and she won't take care of them. Can you take care of them? I was like, no. No.
I'm you partying. Were,
yes, exactly. I was in Palm Springs at a white party, high as a kite. I had no intention. But my partner at the time, who was a very famous casting director in L.A., in New York, wanted kids. And so... 3 days after they were born, I got them. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want them at first. You know, the mother rang the doorbell of my mother's house and left two bassinets down in Philadelphia in the winter and took off before my mom opened the door.
You're kidding me.
Mm. And my mom said...
It's almost biblical.
It is. It is. And my mom, yeah, it is. Wow. And I looked at it like that. My mom said, called me up and said, listen, I've raised all of you and I've raised all these other grandkids.
Yeah.
I'm not raised no more.
Yeah.
So I'm calling social services if you don't come get them. Oh. So I said, really? And my partner was like, okay, that's what I want to do. So we ended up taking them. And that's when I got off of drugs.
Right.
Because I was, you know, I remember them like they were two-ish.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And they were in front of the TV.
Yeah.
And I was living on the Upper West Side. And I remember stepping over them and going out to the man around the corner and realizing that I had left them in the house. And I said, that's it. And that was the end. And that was the end.
Is that beautiful, though?
That was the end of
the
that.
Drugs.
Yes.
Well, just the fact that you realize that. You were putting these young lives in danger.
Mm-hmm.
And that was more powerful than drugs.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
You got a good heart.
Yeah. I thought that, you know, I thought when I got them that I was saving them and they ended up saving me.
That's sometimes the way it works. So your brother's still in jail or is he out?
He just came out recently.
No kidding.
It was great. He was FaceTiming me with my sister. In the car, he hadn't been in jail for forever and like years and years and years. And he's FaceTiming me and you could see that he was like, it was like the Jetsons. He was trying to figure out how to hold the FaceTime. It was hysterical.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Now you guys, have you seen him in person yet?
I did. I saw him last Sunday and for the first time.
Oh my God. How was that?
Powerful.
I can't imagine.
He sent me a letter towards, we separated.
Yeah.
We weren't friends.
Yeah.
We were very close.
Yeah.
And then he went in one direction and I went in another direction. He sent me a letter from jail.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm sorry for hating you all these years.
Oh.
Just because. I guess I was gay, you know.
Yeah.
And it affected me deeply.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And are you guys all right?
I mean, you know.
Yeah.
It's as all right as we can do with all the years that have been separated. You know?
So more to come.
Yeah. We'll see. I think we're okay. We're going through it in a good way.
Mm.
Look, he was so happy. I gave him a whole box of clothes, like a whole bunch of clothes. I don't know whether this is personal to be sharing with everybody, but I gave him a whole bunch of clothes. I don't care. He don't care either.
Yeah.
I gave him a whole bunch of clothes and what you take for granted, what I take for granted.
Yeah.
I forget, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he must have been appreciative.
He's very appreciative. And now he came dressed up looking like a... when I saw him, I said, damn, you look like Lee Daniels.
So how do you get, like... Well, I imagine it's going to be interesting with the kids now, too, huh?
Yeah. Oh. I mean, literally, this is what I'm going through right now in my life.
Wow.
I got to write about it.
And making TV.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Well, that's why I go into the world to escape.
Yeah.
Because when I come back, I got to deal with this mess.
Well, is it a mess? Or is it
just... It's not a mess, but it's messy.
It's heavy.
It's messy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just...
We're trying to make a lot... The kids are great.
Yeah.
They're fantastic. Okay. It's just us that, you know, and how he's dealing with it.
I mean, yeah, guilt, what's going to happen?
His issues.
Oh,
you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But the kids are solid. They're just like, they're clear. She's in Paris spending my money in schools, in film school. Uh-huh. He's in New York modeling, making a lot of money.
Uh-huh.
He's fabulous. Everybody's good.
And then you got the old man's out.
Yeah.
And that's like, now what happens?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. Yeah, there's a movie coming. Wow. Well, that's interesting. So let's talk about, we're going to run out of time because I know you got to run in about 10 minutes. So let's talk about, I want to talk about, you know, how Precious happened. How did you come across that story? Sapphire is amazing.
Isn't she just a tour de force?
Unbelievable.
Did you read the book?
I did read the book.
She's
written a few things.
It shook me to my core.
Uh-huh.
She shook me to my core. I couldn't sleep.
How did you come across the book?
It was part of my sobriety.
Get out.
It was, I had that in a book called Ice, which, by the way, you should see by Ray Shell. I own that, too. That's going to be something else that I'm turning.
Iced.
Dude.
Iced.
Rush out and get a copy, if you can get a copy. I mean, it's out of print, but it's pretty good. So
okay.
I had Precious, I Push, and Iced. And they sort of, and this other thing.
Yeah.
Paperboy. That
became a movie.
Pete Dexter.
Did. Yeah.
And the three of those books got me sober. Helped me with my sobriety. And
how so? By connecting you to other people's experience, your heart?
I don't know what it was about all of it, but you know, I think that the African-American experience viewed from that perspective, really, I don't know.
Yeah, I hear you.
Part of what I was going through.
Yeah.
And I decided to say, I want to make it a movie. And when I went to everybody that, you know, with all the awards that I had, they were like, no. So I had to go out and raise money for it. And I did. And we made a great film I'm really proud of. And
unbelievable. Unbelievable film. And you did it all on your own. They turned they turned you away.
Yes. But I'm used to being turned away.
Yeah. But
from the very beginning, from Monsters Ball On, they said, because nobody wanted to see the movie. Who wants to see a movie, an interracial, you know,
but isn't that a tremendous, you know, in retrospect, you know, like now with Empire, isn't that a tremendous misunderstanding of the audience?
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, I think that, you know, they continue to underestimate the intelligence of the American public. Not just the African American public, but the American public of what it is that is. So it's my job and it's filmmakers' jobs to educate, say, okay, this is what you're gonna see.
Right. And define
this is what you're gonna see.
And when you do it your way, you can do that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Because I just saw the headline of some article that, you know, because of franchises, directors are interchangeable. But that's why people like you who have artistic freedom and license and want to push the boundaries, you've got to keep making your own movies.
Yes.
Yeah. And now you can.
It's like, which one? That's the question. But I'm excited with my, you know, with Empire and Star. You know, I think that, and I'm not complaining about TV. I shouldn't complain about TV because it really is. I'm enjoying telling stories.
It's a lot more immediate, isn't it, than movies in a way? And you can shift and move.
Yeah.
And
cool. I mean, if people you trust. You got to hand over your baby to somebody and pray that the actors know who they, like, that they understand what this vision is. So you got to pray that the showrunner knows and the actors remember. And then you're solid.
Well, have you been, like, you know, coming into that, I mean, how much, because you got some pretty powerful actors.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when... I would imagine after a season, you don't have to ride them too much.
No, they get it. Yeah. I'm good with both shows as a matter of fact. Uh-huh. I think that I have enormous talent on this show. I've been really blessed. You know, as I sit here and I can actually laugh about the homeless joke, that I'm homeless, and yet I started out homeless, and I preferred that homeless because that homeless, at least I knew how to dream. I'm dreamed.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm shifting my spirits like wherever the couch is.
And also we open now, this conversation by talking about how horrible things are in the country and in reaction to that. Mm-hmm. You know, given that you are telling a lot of these stories that you tell, how do you adjust now? Do you adjust? Do you push harder? Are you making adjustments in your mind given that we are now living in unabashed
I've learned that am I allowed to curse?
Yeah.
I don't give a fuck. That's what I've learned.
Uh-huh.
That I will say what the fuck I want to say. I will write what the fuck I want to do because that's exactly what they're doing right now in the White House.
Uh-huh.
And I think that I will try to do it with dignity. You know, it makes me know that I'm right, that my spirit is right and it's clean. And that it's from a pure place. And though as I said before, a lot of people may not want to hear it, I'm going to say it.
Yeah, you got to. You got to. Thanks for talking, man. It was beautiful.
Yeah, man.
Okay, that's it. That is it. That's the show. Don't forget to pre-order your copy of Waiting for the Punch, and then enter yourself in our podcast fan sweepstakes. Go to markmaronbook.com to pre-order and enter the sweepstakes. Now, I wasn't going to play guitar because I'm sick, but people have been liking the dirty guitar. I'm going to go in the house, and I'm going to get my Stratocaster.